From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Joe Biden will be in Pittsburgh today, where he's expected to address the violence in Kenosha and Portland. It's an issue that the Trump campaign has tried to put front and center in the general election.
The president had a remarkable weekend of tweets slamming Democrats, condemning racial justice protesters, retweeting support of a 17-year-old shooter, and also false claims about COVID-19. But much of his attention was on Portland, where far-right groups and a car cavalcade for Trump clashed with counter-protesters over the weekend. A Trump supporter died in a shooting on Saturday. Ahead for the president, a trip to Kenosha, Wisconsin, a trip that both the Wisconsin governor and Kenosha mayor say they don't want the president to make because it could inflame the situation. Here's Mayor John Antaramian speaking to NPR's Weekend Edition on Sunday.
All presidents are always welcome, and campaign issues are always going on. But it would have been, I think, better had he waited for another time to come.
Let's bring in NPR's political correspondent, Mara Liasson. And Mara, the president kept up his attacks this morning, saying the radical left is responsible for violence in U.S. cities. Is this resonating with voters? I heard you say earlier today that support for Black Lives Matter has plummeted.
Well, let me revise and extend my remarks on that. There are at least two polls that I know of that show that support for Black Lives Matter has softened. I don't think I should have used the word plummeted. Mm-hmm. There was one Wisconsin poll that showed net support for Black Lives Matter was plus 25 points back in June and July. Now it's zero. In other words, support for Black Lives Matter is split. There's no net positive. There was a YouGov poll that also showed people saying too much attention is being paid to the racial justice calls. So it's possible that it's working. We don't know yet. We don't have any kind of polling that tells us that.
Okay. Well, President Trump has said that Joe Biden hasn't criticized the anarchist thugs and agitators in Antifa. By the way, it's not known if Antifa is at these protests, but Biden did condemn the violence in Portland, and he's campaigning in Pennsylvania today, where he's expected to address all this. Is Biden able to break through in the moment?
I think that he's going to try. He has condemned the violence, as he said, on the left and the right. He's asked the president to do the same instead of praising what Democrats call pro-Trump vigilantes. What he wants the president to do is to stop praising armed pro-Trump militias. He's going to call on the president to stop fanning the flames of violence, and he's going to flip the Trump attack on its head. You know, the mantra of the Republican convention is you won't be safe in Joe Biden's America. I think in Pennsylvania you're going to hear Joe Biden say you're not safe in Trump's America. This is all happening on his watch.
Well, when you say the president is supporting, according to Joe Biden, the president retweeted a defense of that 17-year-old who shot and killed two protesters in Kenosha. Some high-profile conservatives have rallied around the teen as well. Sean Hannity of Fox, his personal lawyer, is raising money for the 17-year-old's legal team. Ann Coulter tweeted out that the teenager, I want him to be my president. Twitter later took that tweet down. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, everybody predicted that this race would get really ugly, and now it is. Division is something that in the past was always considered to be a bad thing for politicians to engage in. But for Trump, division helps. Us versus them politics worked for him in the past. He clearly thinks this is working for him again. His campaign believes that voters are now shifting on the issues of racial justice, that they're more concerned about rioting and looting than they are about the shootings of unarmed Black men by police. And I think the president is going to continue to hammer on this theme. He thinks it's helping him.
Yeah. Well, the president also retweeted that false claim that COVID-19 has only claimed 9,000 lives. Now, people who back this false theory, you know, say comorbidities like heart attacks with COVID-19 don't count. They do. But has the president successfully shifted the conversation away from COVID-19?
Well, there's no doubt that he has been able to affect the the opinions of his supporters on COVID for quite a long time. It's just not now during the convention. We've seen in polling all along that Republicans take the pandemic less seriously than Democrats do. They're less liable to think wearing masks is important. And in red America, remember the chief of staff, Mark Meadows, said yesterday morning, in Trump's America, if things are peaceful, in red America, yes, the president has been able to shift the conversation to him and his supporters. COVID is in the rearview mirror.
Red America. That's NPR national correspondent Mara Liasson. Thank you.
Thank you.
Louisiana is on a long road to recovery from the damage caused by Hurricane Laura. The storm last week ripped buildings apart and knocked out power to hundreds of thousands of people. In Lake Charles, one of the hardest hit cities, crews are clearing debris and people are coming to grips with the extent of the damage. Tony Guillory is the president of the Calcasieu Parish Police Jury, which is the local governing body similar to a city council, and he joins us now from Lake Charles on his cell phone. Tony, welcome, and what's the situation there today?
Well, right now what we're doing, we're getting everything pushed to the side of the roads. Our electricity company is working quickly as they can. Someone told me that we have approximately about 50 to 60 miles of electricity lines down. If you can imagine that.
I heard, yes, lots of power outages, even some issues with water. What's the biggest need right now for the people there?
Well, I guess the biggest need right now is, I guess, bottled water and basic things. That's the basic thing, because no one has no electricity, no water, no anything. It's just, and these guys are out here working, it's just really hard.
How is local government, the state, and the federal government responding? Have you seen any headway there for relief?
Yes, our governor has been actually talking to the president, and actually the president came in town, and he has just called it a total disaster. So we should start getting funding in for that to help out. But our governor have definitely been on it. Governor John Bell, he is on it, and he is trying to get the most he can for Lake Charles and other parishes around the area.
Tony, we've been hearing people say last week into the weekend that they have never seen or been through a storm like this. Do you feel this way?
150 years, they say. This is the worst storm since 150 years. We took such a huge impact. Winds coming in at about 150 miles per hour. That's very hard. I was in a building, and I know you see the pictures going around from everywhere, but it was definitely horrible.
You said you were in a building. Tell me where you were when the hurricane hit, and what happened to your home and your family?
My home, just the shingles and roof for it, but the roof is still there. But I have just a little compared to what everybody else have down here. I can't complain. I cannot even complain compared to what everybody have. So many people have lost their homes, have just lost their business. It's just, it's going to be a while before Lake Charles comes back to be Lake Charles. I was in one of our storm-proof governing buildings. Our emergency team, ambulance company, a few other people was in there getting ready for the next day, those that had to be there the next day.
The governor has said that the biggest concern is not only making certain that people have power and water and are able to get back into their homes, but also that COVID-19, the numbers will rise because of all of this devastation and interaction between people. Is this a concern for you?
Yes, ma'am, it is. With the COVID situation that we have, it was already bad with the COVID. We were just starting to get our numbers down. But with this, everybody's going to be around. A lot of people are going to be in town. A lot of people are going to be around each other. And it's hot. Although we're asking everybody to wear their masks and everything is still hot and everything, it is a situation that we will have to adjust.
What do you want people to know as you all move through the day and the week trying to get power restored and water up and those types of things?
I want everyone to know, if they are listening and from Lake Charles, that if you have to come to Lake Charles, we ask you to come, do what you have to do to your home or business, and then leave. Because there's a curfew running from 7 to 6. And it is, if you cannot live with just the bare essentials and no one can get to you, to help you for if you get hurt or anything. We're asking you to please leave the city. You know, we have a lot of people in town now trying to do the cleanup, trying to push everything to the side, at least for emergency response and police. But we're asking you to leave the city here. Don't stay. We ask you not to stay. Please don't stay.
Tony Guillory is the president of the Calcasieu Police Jury in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Tony, thank you so much for giving this update, and please stay safe.
Thank you so much. And if anybody want to help, send any supplies, anything, they can also reach me.
And we will put details up on our website, hereandnow.org, on how people can help. Thank you so much, Tony.
Thank you so much. We ask for your prayers and blessings.
Oh, my God, that's huge.
And I didn't write this.
My friend Eleanor Meyer, sister of my best friend Beverly, plopped a huge overstuffed binder in her lap as we sat recently in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to talk, socially distanced, about genealogy. Here's the binder cover.
This says John Van Der Zee of New Baltimore, New York, lineage and allied families, 1793 to present.
Van Der Zee. We've joked about our shared connection to the upstate New York Dutch. Mine, a Mary Vanderveer. Hers, Mary Van Der Zee, wife of John Van Der Zee. But I'm white, Eleanor is black, and her lineage is much tougher to tease out. Her Mary had a previous life, another branch to the family tree.
Now, this is Rebecca Egbertson, and she would have been the first that we know of. There's Caesar and Rebecca Egbertson, and they were enslaved in Cooksackie.
That's Cooksackie in upstate New York. This is a story about Northern slavery and about two women, one white, one black, both shocked to discover they have a connection to it and each other. We start with Eleanor. Her Mary was born in 1801 to the enslaved Egbertsons, sometimes called the Egberts. All the names were given by whites. Slavery had by then been banned in New York, but it lingered. And Eleanor found out through research that even though born free, Mary became a servant companion to the children in the white Dutch family, the Hoddelings.
The Egbertsons were enslaved by the Hoddelings. Mary Egbertson had gotten pregnant at 13, and from the age 13 to 19, she had five children. She had probably been raped. Somebody in the family that held them in bondage.
Oh, just...
You know, it's just, what is it? And we can't even say that that's for sure, but that's what it looks like.
No matter how it happened.
Yes.
It just feels like this must have been a tough go for this 13-year-old girl.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, how does that make you feel?
What can you say? Mm. It's like, I can't go back and fix it. Mm. There's nothing I can do about it, but look at her with wonder that she was able to get, and hope that she did get past it and, you know, didn't live with nightmares and was able to, I don't know, get on.
You came across a notice when she turned 100 and the local New York paper said, her life is a romance.
Yeah.
she was brought up as playmate and companion to children and children's children. This is in the white family she was in. That notion that her life was a romance growing up in this white home.
They're glorifying her, but I'm sure at the same time they wanted her deference. And you sit there and you look and you go, ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is history, but this is also something you carry with you. You are directly related to Mary through one of those early children, Thomas, who took the name Van Der Zee only after Mary married John Van Der Zee. Thomas was your great-great-grandfather. And I know you want to be careful, but you had your DNA tested. You found you carry the white Hoddling DNA in yours.
I have connections on DNA with Hoddlings, but we don't know how. It's still that, yeah, it's probably the male Hoddling, because my grandmother always said that her grandfather, who would have been Thomas Van Der Zee, was fair-skinned. and blue-eyed.
But your grandmother also always used to tell you and Beverly, oh, none of our people were enslaved.
Yeah, she did say that. And it was because there was still, growing up with her, it would be a shame to admit that there had been slaves in the family. But she had to have known Mary Egbert's. Maybe the family told her that we had never been slaves.
Or maybe it was something, as you said, it was a matter of pride.
Pride, yeah. Because when they were able to get their freedom, they also did very well. Mary and John owned their own home. My great-great-grandfather, Thomas, was a steamboat pilot. I found that working on the Hudson on boats, commonly there were a lot of blacks that were able to work in that profession. They had their own homes and did quite well.
There's a picture here.
Yes. That's Mary Egbert's Van Der Zee. And she was 100 years old in the photo. When I saw that face, my mother would always say that me, Beverly Esther, we had the Van Der Zee face. And when I saw this her picture, I knew what she meant because, you know, there's a certain sharpness of features or cheeks or whatever, but it's the Van Der Zee face.
Again, maybe more Egbertson face, Mary's family name. But she also had many children with John Van Der Zee, and this brought us back to the Van Der Zee binder, brimming with material. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's a census. Yeah, and here's some pictures. Descendants of John Van Der Zee.
Family tree.
In the 1800s, yeah. James Van Der Zee, who was the photographer in the Harlem Renaissance.
And a relative of yours.
Yeah, my grandmother's first cousin.
What does it mean to find this?
We had a very small family group growing up, and we knew the name Van Der Zee. We knew about Anson, but we didn't really know who they were and what they had done. And finding out is pretty amazing.
I can't believe how much is here.
Yeah, and I told you now, James Van Der Zee, the photographer, his parents were maiden butler to Ulysses S. Grant. And you find something like this, this is something I never knew. I never knew. I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Well, and also the fact that, you know, I'm of Dutch descent, upstate, yes. New York, same thing. No, they did not have slaves.
Yeah, yeah, and well, you run into a problem too where there are people who want to deny that their family were slaves. But when you're doing this type of genealogy, people want to deny that their families held slaves. When you are trying to reach out to a white family who may be related, they close the door. Mm-hmm. They will disappear. They will block you because they don't want to deal with the fact that they might either have black ancestry or not even ancestry, just kinship. And that's it's the oddest thing that I've kind of run into, but I have run into it where I've lost. Yet one of the last things you tell people is, by the way, I'm black, because boom, it's gone. They don't want to deal with it.
You're saying they don't want to think that their white family, white ancestors had slaves or relations.
They don't want to deal with their families having had slaves in the family. They don't want to deal with possibly having black ancestors, and they don't even want to go so far as to think that one of their ancestors had children who with a black woman or a black man, and that you would be not even related by blood but by a certain kinship. Yeah. They don't want to have that kinship.
Do you think sometimes do you hear from them that they don't know what you want?
Oh yeah, sometimes you'll get what are you looking for and why are you, but right after that comes the door closing.
And what would you want to tell them? What do you want?
I don't know what they're afraid of. This is just history. This is something, you know, this kind of rounds us all out together. I just don't understand why you wouldn't want to know the whole story of your family.
That's all you want?
Yeah, the whole story of the family. Yeah. Good and bad. If you want to claim a king, you have to claim the janitor. They want to be descended from that king. They don't want to hear about the janitor or the scullery maid. You know, they don't want to hear.
Or the steamboat pilot.
Or the steamboat pilot, yeah.
But someone did want to. Eleanor picked up her cell phone to show me one of her resources.
It's called I've Traced My Enslaved Ancestors. It's people posting. They're giving and looking for information on their enslaved ancestors, and many times they find them. They actually tell you different databases that you can go to. Like, you know, this one, 1755, looking for Sarah Creighton, Mary George Dumright, you know.
Is it mostly black Americans
actually,
asking about?
Actually, a lot of white people who found out that their family held enslaved people and have found wills and have found documentation have joined. And it's the greatest thing. A lot of them didn't realize that that's a tremendous resource. People who have wills up in the attic, every bit of information counts.
Can you think of something you found on here?
Well, I found Deborah.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Okay, let's see. Deb, are you there?
I am.
Deborah is Deborah Bruno, who was raised in upstate New York, believing there were no enslaved people in her white family until she found them and posted some of her information on the I Found My Enslaved Ancestors Facebook page. One of her ancestors, the Hodelings, who'd enslaved Eleanor's Mary.
I was terrified because I thought, why would she want to have anything to do with me? My ancestors enslaved hers. My ancestors did terrible things to her ancestors. What right do I have to reach out to her?
Eleanor, as you can guess, felt differently.
Oh, it was serendipity. It was unbelievable because I've always thought Mary's story was compelling. But, you know, it's just my family. And then, you know, she put that up looking for New York, you know, information. Oh, well, this is me. I've got all of this stuff. And I got in touch with her and it was... heads were exploding on both sides of the wire because I was like, oh, my God. And when I gave her the information about the hotelings, oh, my God, my family's what? And I said, Vanderbilt, oh, my God. It was great. And it's almost an immediate kinship. We are coming from the same place.
Tomorrow, what happened after Deborah Bruno and Eleanor Meyer met on the Enslaved Ancestors Facebook page, a meeting that took them to upstate New York, a deep friendship, and more knowledge about the slaves they each didn't know were in their families. That's tomorrow, here and now.
Actor Chadwick Boseman, best known as King T'Challa in the blockbuster Marvel film Black Panther, died on Friday after a 4-year battle with stage 4 colon cancer. And his death is calling attention to a startling statistic. According to the American Cancer Society, Black people have the highest rates of colon cancer of any racial group in the United States. And it's the third leading cause of cancer-related death for both men and women of all races. Dr. Italo Brown is part of an initiative called Barbers Without Borders, where doctors go into Black barber shops and teach customers about the importance of colonoscopies. And he joins us now. Italo, welcome.
Thank you for having me this afternoon.
So Chadwick was 43 years old when he died, 2 years younger than the American Cancer Society's recommended age to start screening. Is this a wake-up call?
Absolutely. In the Black community, we've been aware of the way that colorectal cancer has decimated our numbers, as well as the fact that it is a very seasoned assassin of Black men. We don't do an effective job at screening, and most people find out when they are in an advanced stage because of the insidious nature of the disease.
Black men, as you said, are more likely to get colon cancer and die from it compared to men of other races once they start screening. But the recommendation went from 50 to age 45, and we're seeing that men are being diagnosed younger and younger. What's your advice when you're talking to younger Black men about this?
The first thing that we try to do is to significantly reduce the stigma around the screening for colorectal cancer. Black communities already have significant mistrust with physicians, and so the messenger matters. So when we tell customers at barbershops to be aware of rectal bleeding, to look for pencil-thin stools, to be aware of weight loss that is unintentional or abdominal pain that doesn't seem to subside, and the fact that there may not be full understanding of other factors that play into risk. For example, familial disease of the colon or of colorectal origin. We share that information in a safe space, so it's a lot more easy to be digested.
Hmm. Ryan Coogler, the director of Black Panther, wrote a really touching tribute over the weekend and revealed that he didn't even know about this illness. And in that tribute, Coogler writes, "It is with a heavy heart and a sense of deep gratitude to have ever been in his presence that I have to reckon with the fact that Chadwick is an ancestor now." What kind of impact did Chadwick leave on you? How will you remember him?
Well, I learned a lot through the way that he portrayed these characters. But more importantly, I saw a tweet that said something like, "We thought that Chadwick was playing a superhero when he was a superhero the whole time. A person who pushed his body, his sinew through so much pain so that others could be inspired. That in itself is a blessing. And I think that we have a lot to learn about how you can live your life to the fullest, particularly in times like now. Realizing that a person can endure so much and still find a silver lining, that is huge to me."
Dr. Italo Brown is part of the initiative Barbers Without Borders and an assistant professor of emergency medicine at Stanford University. Dr. Brown, thank you so much for your work.
No, thank you.
Congress is not expected to meet about coronavirus relief measures again until at least after Labor Day. And that means that there is no clear game plan to help tens of millions of people who are unemployed. And as people search for work, we wanted to take a look at what the future might look like. Let's bring in Jane Oates, a former Assistant Secretary of Labor for Employment and Training under the Obama administration. She's now president of the nonprofit Working Nation. Jane, welcome to Here and Now.
Tanya, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
We've received letters from people who are unemployed. They're sharing stories with us about not being able to get back pay. What's your sense of how widespread of a problem this is and how it's being managed?
Well, I think it's a national problem, and it's so hard to really be angry with the state level people who are processing these claims because they're just overwhelmed. And we as a nation have just not invested in the kinds of improvements in their technology to enable them to be ready for something like this. They've been budget cut. I think what I would say is how we can fix it for the really important people, the people who are waiting for their cash benefit, is to make sure they don't make any mistakes when they do their initial claim. Because literally, this is a process where a comma instead of a period can put you back at the end of the line. So really be fastidious when you're applying for your claim. And then I would suggest to people that if they've really had tremendous difficulty. They've waited weeks. They haven't been able to get an answer. They don't know whether they're eligible or not. To try to go to an intermediary, someone like the workforce, the public workforce system, to get a professional's advice on what they could do next. And if they don't know, they don't feel comfortable doing that, going to an organization like Goodwill, really active third-party organizations who assist people when they just seem to have, you know, a problem that they can't solve on their own.
Food service and retail workers are groups that you're really worried about. What are your biggest concerns about their futures?
So selfishly, I worry about them because they're disproportionately women and, quite frankly, disproportionately women of color. And women of color particularly have, when they've suffered downturns in the economic sphere, it's been really slow for them to come back. And easy to understand, right? Women who work in food service like the flexible schedules because they can work around their life schedule, their children's schedule. And now, as they're let go, many of them, you know, I'm sure you've seen the numbers, but, you know, there were over 3 million people who in March thought they were furloughed, but now they realize their job isn't coming back. Yeah. And the 3 million that were in that situation between March and the beginning of July, I'm sure that number is just going to grow. Small restaurants aren't able to reopen. They just don't have the cash. And larger entities are closing some of their locations. So I think that these men and women, of course, who are in these positions really didn't have a lot of reserve anyway, because they weren't very well paid. Even managers in this sector, you know, don't in many states don't surpass the state median income. So these are folks who didn't have a lot of reserve, who didn't know how much they could get on unemployment, now may have exhausted their unemployment, and there's no jobs available for them.
Yeah. You know, a lot of young people also work in these food and retail sectors. Their group hit hard economically by this pandemic. I'm noting that you worked during the recession when millennials were hit hard. What do you worry about most for Gen Zers as we think about future job prospects?
You know, Tanya, they've already gone through a tough time this spring. Very few summer jobs open for them this summer, and many of them had job prospects lined up or internships, and they didn't end up becoming a reality. So as these young people enter the workforce, you know, they're starting out on a 4 or 5 decade career. If they can't get those job skills now, when are we going to make sure they learn those skills? When are we going to make sure they have those experiences? Because if we don't, as a country, take care of these young people, we're going to be paying that price for decades to come. You know, I hope they're as resilient as they seem. I hope they're really looking at some of the options that are open to them and taking advantage of those.
Well, Jane, how do we begin to do all of this in the midst of a pandemic?
Well, a good friend who is with Burning Glass, Matt Siegelman, coined a phrase, lifeboat jobs. And what he meant by that was the fact that this might be the time that you take a job that you never thought you would want to be in and use it for the short term to build skills and pay your bills and show future prospective employers that you had the grit and the resilience to do something with yourself during this pandemic. So a great example is the job that we've never heard of before the pandemic, and that's a contact tracer. Nobody ever wants to see themselves going into a career of calling people and asking who they were with before they knew they were infected. But this is a great job. I mean, it brings in tech. It shows that you have digital literacy and digital skills. It brings in your communication skills, and it really gives you a leg up in what I think for every worker that's out of work right now is a sector they should take a look at, and that's healthcare. I mean, there are not only the traditional jobs that we've always known in healthcare, but there are new job titles being developed nearly every month in that space that might be interesting to you as an out of work person right now.
What other practical tips should we consider? I just spoke with a former busser at a casino in Las Vegas. He had been working in a restaurant for 24 years, laid off. Now he's thinking about what his future holds for the last few years that he has to work before he is eligible for retirement.
So for that casino bus, the busser in the casino, I mean, he obviously had great communication skills. He had to be able to talk to people, you know, to figure out what were the right things to take off tables and what weren't. He also had to be a good relationship manager. He had to both manage with the public and he had to manage all the variety of job titles within a casino. And those folks are really masterful at multitasking. There's nobody who does that better than someone who's a gifted employee in the service industry. So I think that's the first step I would take. Really list out what are the transferable skills that you have, not for a particular job, but all the skills that you had. And then as you use labor market information to look at the jobs in demand in your local area, then try to match those transferable skills with skills that you think might be required in this new job or are actually listed in the job application.
You know, Jane, over and over again, we're hearing that many times people who are unemployed just want to be heard. I can imagine that it's so frustrating just for someone who is trying to get through on the phone to file for unemployment, for instance. They want to be acknowledged. How can friends and family, and even those who are still employed, be more supportive during these tough times?
Well, I think family and friends need to be reflective listeners, need to make sure that when that unemployed friend or family member is talking to you, you're not being judgmental, you're not being negative. You're instead saying, I know how you feel, and I'm so glad I'm not in that situation, but how can I help you? So there are real ways they can help besides just being that good listener. They can review some of the materials that they may be submitting. So they might look at their resume and give them real feedback about it. Or they may look at their cover letter or the email that they're sending when they attach their resume for a prospective job. And of course, the job seeker, you know, has to be ready to hear that. You have to be able to accept advice and sometimes constructive criticism and be open to new ideas. So I would say, everybody's confused about what the new normal is going to be. And I think that means a lot more people will be looking to hire temporary help through agencies rather than incur a full-time employee with benefits.
So much here. Jane Oates is a former Assistant Secretary of Labor for Employment and Training during the Obama administration. She's now president of the nonprofit Working Nation. Jane, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya, so much, and keep up your good work.
We know about the importance of face masks to slow the spread of the coronavirus, but researchers are pushing something even simpler. Be quiet. Shh. Be quiet. Or don't talk at all. Derek Thompson has been looking at the research. His article is Mask Up and Shut Up. He's staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does every Monday. Derek, get right to it. You spoke with Professor Jose Jimenez from the University of Colorado Boulder, who has looked at talking and transmission. What did he find?
Thank you, first of all, for having me, Robin. So this is a very important point. This is a disease that spreads through the air, and it spreads predominantly through the droplets that we create when we sneeze, cough, or talk, especially when we yell. There's two kinds of droplets. There are large droplets that come, especially when we sneeze or yell or shout or scream. And there's also the spray that comes from our mouth, sometimes when we just talk normally. Those are called aerosols, these tiny little spray-like particles that can linger in the air in a swirling cloud. Those are the two ways that this disease predominantly spreads. And if we are quiet or if we don't speak at all, we are much less likely to produce the droplets that convey this virus. Compared to yelling, quiet talking reduces aerosols by a factor of 5, and being completely silent reduces them by a factor of 50. So I'm definitely not suggesting that we should stop talking about masks or stop talking about ventilation or stop talking about taking activities outside, but I am saying maybe we should talk more about not talking.
Right, or talking quietly. Look, you write that when we're evaluating risk, we need to think of this soundscape of interactions with other people. So a socially distanced movie theater where no one's saying a word may actually be less risky than a socially distanced restaurant where people are still yelling to try to be heard.
Right. There is not going to be a risk-free space that is indoor and unventilated, which is why I would stop short of telling people to rush back to movie theaters. It is not as risk-free as staying at home or having a picnic outside. But as long as we're comparing indoor restaurants versus movie theaters. Well, in indoor restaurants, people are talking and chewing and slurping and sometimes laughing loudly at each other, right in each other's faces if they're sitting across the table. In a movie theater, especially in a movie theater that isn't causing, I don't know, uproarious laughter or screaming, people are mostly sitting, hopefully spatially distanced, hopefully with masks, in a quiet space. So at least we're comparing these two indoor activities that a lot of cities or individuals might be in a rush to reopen. If we're comparing the relative risks, I would say, and the experts I talked to agreed, that movie theaters are probably safer than indoor restaurants where people are talking relatively loudly.
But it's because, again, you know, you don't have to go to a movie theater. Just everywhere, just don't speak loudly. And you point to Japan as an example of a place where quiet talking is a cultural thing, especially, for instance, on public transportation, and they have fewer infections. Talk about that.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating because many things in Japan have returned to normal. And one of those things that's returned to normal is transit ridership. Their famously crowded subways in Tokyo are back to normal. And epidemiologists have not yet traced any outbreaks to those subways. So why? Well, the subways are typically well-ventilated. They tend to be newer cars than the U.S. has in a lot of subway systems. And surely the Japanese have decades of practice wearing masks that the Americans do not. But a key thing here is that Japanese commuters also have, as you said, an informal rule to either talk very, very quietly or mostly not at all. And that might be a key driver of the fact that this has been a safe space for the Japanese to return to. And so just to juxtapose here, you know, New York City is spending between $10 and $15 million a month on what I've called hygiene theater. That's blasting its subways with antimicrobial sprays and buying a bunch of soap and soaping down the walls and the poles. Well, the Japanese are keeping their trains safe with a much cheaper technology. It's silence and masks. And I just think that again and again, the public health officials just haven't clearly returned us to the way this virus spreads and the little things we can do, even in public spaces, to reduce its likelihood of transmission. Put on a mask and speak very quietly, if not at all.
Right. We only have about a minute here, but this was already one of our favorite topics because we've learned that during the 1918 flu pandemic, Boston officials fined people for spitting, kissing, or being a big talker, they were called. You were fined for that. But, you know, people are resisting wearing masks. So just, you say, put up signs, hush for your health, things like that. What are people going to do? I mean, I was around a boisterous young person. He's just got all this energy and enthusiasm, but you think people really will be quiet if they're told to be quiet?
There is a partisan difference in terms of the share of people that wear masks, but the polls seem to indicate that 70% of Americans are okay wearing masks and say they do wear masks. That is tens of millions of people more wearing masks than were in February or March. We can do the same with silence in public spaces. We just need people to understand this is the science.
Turn everything into the library. Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. We'd love your thoughts at hereandnow.org. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young. The biggest study ever of the planet's melting ice shows a 28 trillion ton loss, causing rising sea levels, warming temperatures. Scientists say the findings are concrete evidence of man-made climate change.
Now we've got 20 or 30 solid years of satellite measurements. It's really impossible for people to deny that that's happening.
Next time, Here and Now.